Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
So, as you may have read, I started my career long years ago in psychiatry. Then I moved to work with the Labrie Fellowship, a Christian study center, in England, and then I'm teaching at Covenant Theological Seminary in the United States, and I've been teaching counseling there for 24 years. I have a particular interest in sexuality, in helping the church to talk about sex without too much embarrassment and fear, because it's everywhere else, but the church, you know, everyone else is talking about it. We're having a harder time really dealing with this and helping people, Christians, to live more faithfully in this area. We talk a lot about pornography, and I do a lot of counseling and am involved with several ministries that are dealing with various areas of sexual brokenness, of homosexuality, of pornography. But then we have this area of helping couples deal with struggles in sexuality in their own marriage. So that's what I want to talk about, enhancing the beauty, engaging with the brokenness of sex within marriage. And I want to start just thinking of the incredibly sort of radical statements that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians 7 about sexuality and marriage. Radical in the sense of very different from the culture around them, where a man would basically own his wife's body and be able to demand from her whatever he wanted. And Paul talks a lot in this passage about mutuality. It's a beautiful expression in all sorts of ways. Mutuality of faithfulness to each other, having just your spouse and no one else. Mutuality of responsibility for each other's bodies. You are mutual owners. God owns your bodies, but you own each other's bodies and have responsibility for them, in caring for them. There's a mutual consent. Paul says, when you abstain from sexual relationships, then it should be by mutual agreement. It shouldn't be just one-sided. And it should be for good reasons. It might be for fasting and prayer. It might be for health reasons or whatever. But it should be something that you agree on and not just one person forcing it on the other. And then he's realistic. Paul is very realistic about the danger of temptation. And if you abstain for too long, then one or other of you may be tempted to go elsewhere to look for satisfaction. And then finally, as we see in Ephesians 5, the whole message of submission within marriage is not just the wife submitting to the husband and doing whatever he wants, but Paul starts that whole section, the end of Ephesians 4, with submit to one another. And this is the way in which you submit to one another. Wives to husbands, husbands to wives, parents to children, children to parents, in a sense, and slaves to masters. But the emphasis there is that each should be seeking the greater good of their partner within marriage. So all of these principles apply to every part of the marriage relationship. And particularly here, we're going to be talking about the sexual area. Now, sex, I sometimes call my talk on sexuality agony and ecstasy, because it is the place where we experience a lot of agony, a lot of pain. There are so many areas of life that are affected by our sexuality, and we'll be looking at them more in the post-forum. But if you think of just a few, and these are the things where they are a result of the fall. God created us to enjoy each other, male and female, and he created us to enjoy our bodies, our sexuality. But we have to work against the ways in which we're fallen. And one of them, of course, coming out of Genesis 3, is that men tend to rule over women. That's not what God intended to happen. That is a result of the fall. And then women as a result, tend to want to get their own back and rule over the men, or get back at them in some way. We live, too, in a culture which has got rid of all boundaries in relation to sexuality, and so anything goes. And that means that many people come into marriage, especially if they've recently become Christians, with a lot of bad experience in their bodies and in their minds, in their emotions, in their awareness of relationship. So many couples, including Christian couples, go into marriage having been living together, probably with several partners before they get to marriage. Many people come into marriage with experiences of sexual abuse, more women than men, but both sexes are vulnerable to this. And that will leave them damaged and wounded and have a hard time to know how to express their sexuality. The number of people that I've talked to who have been abused by women who've been abused by their fathers, or in their families, have been given a very negative message about sex. Sex is bad, sex is disgusting, it's not something we talk about. And therefore they come in very inhibited, either by the damage and the fear and the anxiety that sex provokes, or just a negativity about it in their whole being. And then, of course, pornography and sexual addiction, which are the plague of our world. I think that probably somewhere between 70 to 90% of our students, men, male students at the seminary, are struggling to a significant degree with pornography. So that's Christians going into pastoral ministry. And a significant number of women, and the number of women struggling with pornography is increasing as the years go by. And of course, it is attractive because real relationships are difficult, aren't they? You know, those of us who are married know that it's hard work loving each other and being kind to each other and romancing each other and caring daily for each other. And for men and women who want to take the shortcut route to sexual arousal and some sort of physical satisfaction of orgasm, they can masturbate with pornography. And it's simple. It's not complicated. It just takes maybe a few minutes. And you're done. And you can find any image you want. You don't have to work at the relationship. So fantasy is easier than reality. And many people think that once I get married, then this will solve my problem with pornography. And of course it doesn't, because it's a habit that goes on. And sex with pornography is different from sex with a real person. So you have to learn how to deal with that difference. And well, I'll be talking more about that in the post forum. These things, and then finally, of course, these last two, more and more people coming out in the open and struggling with same-sex attraction. We run a group for men we run groups for men and women who are struggling with same-sex attraction, and more than half of those groups are married men or women. So they may be somewhat bisexual, but they have got into a homosexual lifestyle alongside their marriage. And then the whole concept of transgender and gender fluidity is confusing the waters and the culture around us, of people wanting to know what is masculinity and femininity, and is it real? Maybe we're all just one sex and it's a cultural, socially constructed thing that we're male and female. That's for another workshop tomorrow. So in thinking about the Bible and its incredibly positive view of the goodness of sex, and many people who have grown up with a negative view have to dig into the scriptures and dig into that and be able to accept that God's original intention was that within marriage, Our bodies and our sexuality are good things to be enjoyed. So the Song of Solomon is a startlingly erotic, sensual book, isn't it? So in the old days, long years ago, it was seen, because it was so erotic and sexual, this couldn't be real. This was just a metaphor, an allegory. So the church interpreted, when the Song of Solomon talks about kisses, they would say it's not people kissing each other, it's God kissing us from heaven. Or when the Song of Solomon talks about breasts, this is the nurturing doctrine of the church, and so on. So it was seen as metaphorical and allegorical. there is this, the real sense that marriage and the sexual relationship in marriage does really point to the relationship between God and Israel, between Christ and the church. So Paul picks that up when he's talking about the mutuality of the sexual relationship in Ephesians. And he talks about the way in which the bride of Christ, the church, is being prepared for the deepest intimacy that we will ever know, intimacy with Christ himself, the divine bridegroom. So sexuality is pointing beyond itself. Now, the Song of Solomon is seen, I think, today, either as a narrative story or several stories, or the way that I would see it is that it's an anthology of love poems, so a collection of love poems. And you could say it's a window into the heart of God, in terms of it's a love song that expresses something of the love song of God to us, but also of how we should relate to each other. You could say it's sort of lessons in lovemaking. And what you see in this is there's a sort of, it's almost like sex before the fall. You know, there's no shame in the man and the woman desiring each other and thinking about each other's bodies and thinking about, you know, from head to toe. Song of Solomon describes in pretty graphic detail, and in language that is not too difficult to understand, metaphorical language of fruit trees and fountains, they're obviously allusions to our sexuality. So Allender and Longman say in their book about sexuality, the desire to be captured by delight is the one of the most lovely and holy desires of the heart. The delight of God for us, and a man for a woman for a man. And that's what you see communicated. So there's quite a lot about communication in the Song of Solomon. Creativity, you know, he is the king of my heart, she says. She uses imagination, fantasy. I always get a little confused when I'm using the words imagination and fantasy. We tend to think of fantasy as a bad thing. So I'm going to use the word imagination for the God-given capacity to think sexually about someone else, which is not a bad thing. Obviously, outside marriage, you have to be careful where your imagination takes you, because it can easily take you into lust. But to think and to imagine what it would be like being with this woman or this man and making love to them and what their body is like is not a bad thing to do. And knowing the difference, and we'll come on to that in a minute, between men and women. So it talks, the Song of Solomon talks about the physical, not the non-physical communication, but then also the physical. So the enjoyment of kissing, the enjoyment of touching and caressing, the delight and pleasure in sensuality and eroticism, allowing these passions and emotions to come out. And making love is sort of like learning to dance. And you can tread all over each other's toes, and you can bump into each other. And most of the research shows that couples who have been married for a long time have the most satisfying sexual relationship. So it's experience in the context of long-term commitment, of knowing each other's bodies, knowing each other's minds and hearts, that enables you to be able to dance together the most effectively. And then in the Song of Songs, there are hints about the reality of the struggle. And then finally, there are the warnings that come, and I'm not going to take the time to read the passages that describe all these things I've been talking about, except maybe to say that, let me go to the warning, which is repeated three times, sort of like a little refrain. Amidst all this sensual eroticism, the writer says, "Don't arouse or awaken love until it so desires." That's the NIV translation. So there's a time and a place when this is good and God-given, but be careful you don't awaken it too early, which is what everyone in our culture does in dating relationships. They so often go to sex very early on. Or the New Living Translation is, "Don't awaken love until the time is right." So what then about difficulties? Here we come to dealing with the difficulties in the relationship. What are the common difficulties for women? There's a study being done at the moment. They did a sort of first part, and it's ongoing. You can actually contribute to it online. If you look up sex in Christian America, I guess I'm not sure whether you have to be living in America to do it, but anyway, what they found in, these are the preliminary results, and this is amongst evangelical Christian women, okay? Finding energy for sex, 42%. I'm sure some of you can echo this in your own hearts. Feeling sexual desire, 35%. Reaching orgasm, 22%. Becoming sexually aroused, 20%. Pain most or every time, 12%. And no sexual difficulty, 25%. So this is a significant struggle within the sexual relationship. So there's a whole army now of sexual therapists, especially in the United States, who are dealing with this. And the most significant thing that they're saying is that even though all this knowledge we have about sex, so many people struggle with desire, both men and women. But the difficulties for men now, if you contrast them with the women, the common difficulties that they would complain about, the first is premature ejaculation, 22%, finding energy, 16%, maintaining an erection, 12%, and getting an erection, 4%, so 16% having problems with an erection, desire, 9%, no difficulty, 50%. There's quite a difference between the men and the women here. So to understand difference is incredibly important. And when we talk about the difference between men and women, one of the problems is, how do we know what's created difference? How do we know what's a result of the fall? And how do we know what's a result of cultural expectations and influences? And the answer is, we don't. But we can guess from the sort of biblical framework we have, we can have some clue of what it is. And then expectations in marriage of sexual intercourse. These are reports of actual frequency, not what I would like, but more, this is what happens. So it obviously gets less with time, with age. Age 25, 2%, not in the past year, 9% monthly, few times a month or once a week, 46%, 2 to 3 times a week, 37%, and then 4 or more a week, 6%. And then, as I've said, going down in the later years. But couples still go on having sexual intercourse way up into their 70s and 80s, but their bodies now, you know, a man's testosterone begins to drop off in his 30s, or even a little bit younger, which for men who have a high sexual drive, that is actually quite a relief. I mean, I certainly can testify to that in terms of the sort of drivenness of one's sexuality. That not to feel that all the time and to be noticing it all the time is a relief for many men. And for women, they often come into their sexual prime in their 30s and 40s. And the good thing about this balance is that men are beginning to slow down and the women are beginning to understand and know their bodies better and maybe have had their children and got past that and can have more time to enjoy the marriage relationship if the marriage has stayed long enough to survive that in this day and age. So they sort of meet each other better in their 30s and 40s if all goes well. So in terms of the differences then, what do men and women want? Well, men tend, and this is, here we get into the dangers of caricature. I'll say a little more about that in a moment. But men tend to want to go for intercourse and orgasm and sort of a bit more variety than maybe women want. Women are... Certainly they want sex, but they want emotional and physical closeness and cuddling. And about 35% of the women in this study, the first part of this study, said they would be very happy not to ever have intercourse. They'd be happy just to cuddle. So that's a very important part of the sexual relationship. And in later life, older couples get more content with just enjoying each other's bodies without necessarily going to intercourse and orgasm. So understanding, enjoying, and redeeming the difference, it's recognizing we're made in the image of God, male and female. So there's obviously physical difference. There's the ability to bear children. There are hormonal differences, differences in the brain. But it's really hard to pin down what those differences are. And I'm not going to try and give you a list of them, but we can say we are more alike than we are different in our humanness. Okay? And there's a real danger of caricatures, this sort of caricature, what we call neurosexism, where we say all men want is sex. Women never want sex, or something like that. And all women want to do is talk, and all they need is security and so on. And men are interested in TV and football and beer and sports and all these sorts of things. Now, obviously, that's a gross caricature because there are many men who really want love and security and respect. And there are women who enjoy sport and enjoy sex and enjoy food and all these other things. So I think that it's, you know, here's the sort of typical distribution curve where there are, and this is where we get into gender stereotypes as well as sexual difference, there's a lot of overlap. So a man can be very gentle, kind, and remember that the fruits of the Spirit are for all people, men and women. So patience, gentleness, kindness, we think of those as typical feminine virtues. They are to be for men too. But there are some women who have a stronger sex drive than men do. And that sort of flips the usual direction that it is when you're doing... I've had a number of couples who've come to me where the man really doesn't have a very strong desire for sex. The woman has it more strongly, and they feel weird because they know this isn't the way most people are. So that may happen in terms also of interests, of physical strength. Some women are very strong and tough, and some men are fairly, you know, have a small body build and not that strong. So it's sort of respecting and learning and getting to know each other and respecting and enjoying the differences. So when we come on to thinking about desire, men in general do tend to think about sex more than women, as you can see from these figures. So few men think about it hourly, thinking about wanting sex, some daily. Men 81%, women 57%. Weekly, men 38%, women 13%. So in general, it's men more than women, but there are always going to be exceptions. And this desire, as we'll see in a minute, is affected by many things. When you think about desire, men think about and want sex more. There's a lovely story, this is a little tangent here, that when the Apollo mission astronaut Neil Armstrong, you remember he was the one who stepped on the moon and gave his famous "one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." It's said that one of the people listening on the ground heard him say, "Good luck, Mr. Gorsky." And for years people wondered, and they asked him, "Who is this Mr. Gorsky?" And he said that he couldn't tell them. They thought maybe it was a rival Soviet cosmonaut or something that he was talking about, but there was no one by that name. So on July the 5th in Florida, while he was answering questions following a speech he'd given, a reporter again brought up the question 26 years later of, "Who's this Mr. Gorsky you mentioned?" And he said, "Well, actually, I can tell you now, because Mr. and Mrs. Gorsky have died. So I'm free to tell you the story." And he said, when I was a child, I was playing baseball with my friend, and his friend lived next to Mr. and Mrs. Gorsky. And he hit the ball over into the Gorsky's backyard. And he went and he was getting the ball from just below the window of the house. And he heard Mrs. Gorsky shouting, "Sex, Mr. Gorsky? You'll get sex when the boy next door walks on the moon." Now, it happens that story is not really true, but it's a great story anyway. But it sort of epitomizes this caricature we have of men and women. So for women, as most of you know, that the women tend to take longer to get aroused. So it takes a woman an average of 15 to 20 minutes. For a man, it might be 2 or 3 minutes to become sexually aroused. Men can do it in any mood, whether they're anxious, angry, sad, whatever it is. For them, it's often a relief of tension. For women, that mood tends to interfere. Anxiety interferes with arousal, or sadness, or distraction with children. Men like to be stimulated, their genitals to be touched very early on in a sexual encounter. And they think women like that too, and they often do the wrong thing and put the woman off, because they go for the breasts and the genitals too early, before the woman is feeling arousal. And that may be very uncomfortable for the woman at that point. So they need to learn that foot rubs and rubs of the neck and other parts of the body need to come first, and that the making love needs to be done in the context of enjoying each other in the hours before making love, and not just something that the man can expect his wife to enter into quickly when he jumps into bed with her. And then the time and energy that we talked about is something that, you know, it's easy for men, it's harder for women when they are tired. So coming on to some of the more specific problems here, I'll come to how we deal with the frequency of orgasm in women. You can see here that it's very different from men. So for men, it's 93% below the age of 40 experience orgasm every time. Every time for women, 25%. Never 8%, half the time 15%, often 32%. So this can leave a woman aroused but frustrated, or feeling, well, what's the point? Why bother? Just let him get on with it. And, you know, I'll put up with that. So that the area that sexual problems can come in any of these areas, but you know, it's the inability to enjoy lovemaking and or to have sexual intercourse. And the problems come at any stage. They can come at the beginning in terms of desire and arousal and orgasm. And the problems, of course, are often not in bed, but sometimes they are. So you need to deal with the relationship problems as well as the specific, what we call behavioral aspects of sexual intercourse. So the loss of desire, it may be loss of desire and arousal, erectile dysfunction, pain on intercourse, and then orgasmic dysfunction. These are the main categories that we're going to look at briefly here. So in general then, when a counselor or someone who's doing, if you're doing premarital counseling, it's really important to ask about the sexual history. So usually most good premarital counselors have a session or two, and I think it's helpful for if there's someone in the church who's willing to see, for example, my wife is often, the pastor often asks my wife to see, he may be doing counseling with a couple, and he says to my wife, Jane, would you see this particular person, and I will talk to the man, and I've talked to them together. But to ask specific questions about their sexual history, pornography, previous relationships, and all those things. So learning to really listen and ask good questions, and you obviously want to know what their family environment was like, what sort of relationship did their parents have, how was sex talked about, was it talked about, where did they have their first sexual knowledge and experience, was it from pornography, was it from their peers in school, what are their expectations in relation to sex? And of course, if you have I've been seeing just recently a couple where the man had a very heavy use of pornography before he was married. The woman came from a family which was very inhibited about sex and emotions. So they had a really hard time consummating their marriage, and then actually enjoying each other. It's going to be a slow, long process. So you have to be very patient with this. So you, in taking this story, you're finding out some of the predisposing factors that may affect their marriage in the present. And then in talking about what's going on in the marriage, you're finding out the factors that are perpetuating the difficulties. You need to talk about the differences between men and women, some of the ones I've described, so that they're aware and educated about that. So you're really asking questions, you're listening, and at the same time you're educating somewhat. You're recommending good books. I think it's always helpful for them to read a book about sex before they get married. And you want to know what their communication style is about relationship problems, about making love. Can they even talk about? Can they? And as a counselor who deals with sexual problems, I'm very comfortable using the words penis and vagina. And most younger people today are, but older people tend to be embarrassed and have difficulty doing that. But to be able to name body parts and give them permission to talk to each other about what gives pleasure and what interferes with pleasure is really important. So education, information, permission, differences between men and women, these are things you're going to be dealing with as you begin. And then as you get into it, you obviously want to know whether the problem is primarily out of bed or in bed. And we'll come back to that as we go along. So this desire can be stifled, as Dan Allender says, by memories of misuse, shame, disappointment, and anger. So if the marriage has got off to a bad start in terms of the relationship, and if the husband is particularly insensitive to his wife, that immediately is giving her experiences and memories, or if she's had them in a previous relationship, or being abused by someone as a child, those memories have a profoundly interfering effect on desire. It's a complex area, and it's more complex, as I've said, for women than men. So, and the causes we can talk about are physical, psychological, and relationship. And this is a little bit like making lists, which I don't like doing for you, but I'm just going to mention a few things as we go through. So the physical factors that affect desire and arousal, some women are profoundly sensitive in their menstrual cycle, so that around ovulation is the time when they feel the most sexual desire and arousal. The rest of their cycle, any desire or interest is almost absent. So they have to be aware of this difference and talk to each other about it and help each other to use this in a positive way. If one or other of them is ill, obviously that's going to, any sort of illness will interfere with desire and arousal. Testosterone is much debated. Now men have a lot more testosterone. And women who have high testosterone levels tend to have a high sex drive and a high interest. But giving testosterone, either you know as a pill or as a patch which is absorbed into the body, does not necessarily enhance sexual drive and desire. There's a lot of debate about this, whether this should be used. Alcohol. People often think that this helps. Well, it helps you to feel some arousal, but it often defeats your performance. So actual erection and orgasm is affected in a negative way with alcohol. Drugs of addiction will obviously inhibit medication for depression. So a lot of people are on antidepressants, and there are one or two specific antidepressants that do not affect sexual desire or performance as much. But there are many of them that do affect it in a negative way. Oral contraception may affect desire. So early on in marriage, this may be one of the things that needs to be juggled. And this is why they need to talk to the doctor about which one would be the most helpful. And then, of course, age. The psychological, the loss of interest may be due to a history of pornography or a current use of pornography or an affair, whether an emotional affair or a physical affair. But quite a number of women discover their or become suspicious about their husband's sexual activities because they notice his lack of interest in them, as the spouse. Stress and overwork, obviously, time and energy, loss of sleep. These all are very relevant around pregnancy, childbirth, and the authors of this study in their original book on this said that after a woman has her first child, her sexual interest drops 50%. After the second child, it drops another 50%, and after the third, another 50%. That's obviously an exaggeration, but they're making the point that it does, you know, for a woman who's sleep deprived, exhausted, her body has been changing up and down, and continues to change, it may not be easy. So this may be a difficult time for the man where he needs a husband who needs to be patient with his wife. With the whole situation. And then depression, anxiety, I've mentioned pregnancy, childbirth. So these are the current life circumstances. The past experiences would be obviously past relationships and I've mentioned a lot of these already, sexual attitudes of parents, poor body image, self-image. One couple that I was seeing a while ago, and the young woman found it incredibly difficult to look in a mirror at herself. Not even clothed, she couldn't look in a mirror with any sense of, I see anything good about myself. And to look naked was even more was terrifying for her, because she had such a low view of her body. And over time, I had to help her, and her husband too had to help her, with a lot of affirmation from him, to begin to look at her body and get used to seeing it, and to begin to actually thank God for the different parts of her body. Thank you, God, for the breasts that you have given me. Thank you, God, that you made my legs long and thin, or whatever it is. That's a really hard thing to do. And then we've mentioned sexual abuse and pornography and homosexuality. And in times of stress, when a man or a woman who have struggled with same-sex attraction but have also been able to be attracted to the opposite sex, so some bisexuality, which is more common in women than men, in times of stress in their marriage, their old same-sex attraction may emerge again and may lead them into having an affair, which exposes this and really can do great damage to the marriage and the trust. So, and then out of bed, there are all the problems of hostility, of anger, of threats. If there's an abusive spouse, obviously there's not going to be a lot of interest in sex. If there's a controlling relationship where there's intimidation and humiliation and forced sex and a forced submission, who's going to want sex in that sort of environment? If there have been affairs, I'm repeating a number of things here. And then lack of self-care, taking care of one's body, says Lisa McMinn, one's body offers a gift and a blessing to one's spouse. And some people who have never learned good body hygiene and habits need to learn this within marriage in terms of just offering themselves to their spouse in a way that is acceptable. That's less of a problem than it used to be, and obviously in days gone by when showers weren't available and baths were not taken very often, that must have been a really difficult problem for many marriages. And then problems of different expectations and fantasies, ideas of what's fun and healthy. And this comes from the culture and from Cosmopolitan magazine and from pornography. Most young people are learning about sex from pornography, aren't they, nowadays? So I came up with this list. I was thinking, these aren't exactly from the Bible, but from biblical principles, I think we can come up with a few principled boundaries within marriage. The first, obviously, is no sex outside marriage. Well, that's definitely there in Scripture. The sex is using one's sexual imagination within bounds. That's also there in Scripture. It's okay for a man or a woman to look at the opposite sex and say, thank God there are differences, we can enjoy the beauty of the opposite sex body. There's a very beautiful woman. But when I start undressing her in my mind and thinking of making love to her, that is going into the area of lust, and my imagination is going into sin. So, within certain bounds, and the sexual imagination is really important in the Song of Songs and for a couple. And some women, I think many women, find it hard to allow themselves to imagine making love to their husbands. I think women find that more difficult than men do, because men tend to be more visual in general. And then no habitual or addictive masturbation. Now that's a whole other topic we could get into, because the Bible doesn't talk at all about masturbation. But I think that the real danger with masturbation is that it becomes a substitute, that it becomes addictive, and it's usually used with lustful fantasy. It's hard to masturbate without fantasy. Now you could say, well, for within a marriage where a husband or a wife is away for a while and they have to be apart, you know, the guy's gone to war in Iraq or Afghanistan or something, and he's away for 6 months, for some sort of sexual relief, can that wife or the husband imagine their spouse and making love to them? And I, quite honestly, I do not have an objection to them occasionally using masturbation in that way. Some Christians would say, no masturbation ever. But it's an area that, but the problem is it so easily becomes habitual and addictive, and that's why I've used these words. I think no pornography. Many couples nowadays think it's fine to watch pornography together and do the things that they see. Couples dating, you know, and having sex. Many couples do this. I think no anal sex. You know, in pornography and in many discussions about sex, this is something that is just accepted nowadays as normal. And let me be quite blunt about this. The anus is not meant for taking things in. It's meant for pushing things out of your body. And anal sex, there are often tears to the intestinal rectal mucosa, the surface, the lining of the gut, and that allows sexually transmitted diseases to occur much more easily. And when you look at the studies done on who likes this, it's usually the men. The women, after one or two tries, do not like it at all. It's uncomfortable, it's not particularly loving, it's hard to have an orgasm that way for the women. And then in the age of 50 Shades of Grey, I think you don't need bondage and domination and sadism and masochism in a good marriage relationship to get sexually aroused. If you do, I think something has gone wrong. You've gone over certain boundaries. But nowadays, again, culturally, people are saying, well, anything goes. Why not? If it gets you aroused, if that's what you like, why not? And I think anything that a couple do should be safe, consensually agreed, and caring for each other. So there should always be agreement. It shouldn't be one forcing something on the other. So going then to problems of male arousal, this gets a little more medical. So men 10% over 50 have erectile dysfunction. And quite often this is physical. It may be partly aging, it may be illness. So men with diabetes have narrowing of the arteries to the penis. The blood supply is diminished. They have a hard time getting an erection. So you may have to treat the illness. You may have to change medication, which may be affecting the ability to get aroused. Or if it's psychological, some men who fail to get an erection when they're trying to make love, then they get very anxious and they start to fear, gosh, will I be able to do it next time? Next time comes round and they're sort of watching themselves and getting more and more anxious. And of course, anxiety inhibits the erection. So they bring about the very thing they fear. So what you have to do is help them to what we call sensate focus in order to eliminate the performance anxiety. You might say, Well, you're not to actually have intercourse for 2 weeks. And what I want you to do is two or three times a week, you're to have a time when you enjoy each other's bodies without going on to intercourse. You caress, you massage, whatever you can tolerate, which doesn't arouse you so much that you feel you have to go on to intercourse. And this takes some of the anxiety out of it, and the man finds very often that he gets an erection very easily that way, when he's not thinking, is it going to happen or not? And once he's got it, then you can give them permission to go further along. But it's amazing what wonderful things banning intercourse can do, what problems it can solve. And then, of course, nowadays we have Viagra and Cialis. Those, I don't know what the name, there'll be different names in your culture, but drugs to help to maintain erection. And in America, they're all over the TV ads all the time. And it's interesting that the rise of these drugs exactly parallels the rise of pornography. Now, is it possible that many men are not able to get erections and get interested in normal sex because they've got so used to pornographic sex? And you need to treat the problems of pornography with these drugs. I think that's partly true. Delayed ejaculation, where a man may have difficulty having an orgasm, may be caused by medication, maybe guilt over having an affair or stress at work, just low general arousal and interest, and then, of course, age. And as you get older, you have to get used to the body not being able to do some of the things it used to be able to do. I'm just learning that slowly but and rather reluctantly as age creeps up on me. Premature ejaculation is a common problem, well, quite a problem for men. And again, when a boy, often from the age of 11 or 12, has been masturbating with pornography, and then he enters into marriage, he has to change his habits because he can't just get aroused and then have an orgasm as he's used to doing. He has to learn to delay that orgasm to hopefully meet his wife and keep going long enough for her to be able to have an orgasm too. Simultaneous orgasm for men and women is pretty rare, but obviously that's what most men and women would like to get to in this dance of sexual intercourse. Stress and anxiety, performance anxiety. And so you have to, there are ways, techniques of helping men to learn more control. And I'll give you a reference for a book at the end which has these techniques described in it. An antidepressant medication also has that effect. Now, another problem, this is the problem for women, and a couple I was seeing too a little while ago, this was their main problem. They came because they could not had been married for 3 months and hadn't been able to consummate their marriage. And the woman was getting severe pain whenever they tried to do it. So we needed to hear, I needed to take good sexual history, the story of, you know, was sex a very negative thing in her family? Well, yes, that was one thing that was true. And then she went for a medical examination had a vaginal examination. And the doctor said, yes, your vaginal muscles are very tight. It's very difficult for me to insert an instrument inside you. And so this is what we call vaginismus, which is spasm of the vaginal muscles. Now that might happen because someone has been sexually abused. It happens in some women for no particular reason, maybe just partly anxiety. And if they have this one anxious experience early on in the relationship, then obviously it will come again without some help. But it's not too difficult to treat this. Teaching relaxation exercises, whole body, so every muscle group, teaching those, and breathing exercises to help the relaxation and reduce anxiety. But then very specific, learning how to relax the pelvic muscles and the muscles around the vagina. That's something that there are specialist physiotherapists who do this now, who specialize in this area. That's something that can be taught. And then very often we would ask the woman to buy dilators, which are just plastic, increasing size, penis-shaped, obviously, that they can use with lubrication. And once they've used those and learn relaxation, then they go back to making love together and the husband helping his wife, being sensitive to making sure that he is not doing anything to produce the anxiety again. And it may be necessary with them, as I did with this particular couple, to say, look, I don't want you to even try and make love and have intercourse. Maybe for 2-3 months. You can stimulate each other without intercourse, and the woman could stimulate the man to orgasm, the man, the woman to orgasm, but you are not to actually have intercourse. So that would be the sensate focus part of it there. And then the problems of female arousal and orgasm, for those you have to sort of go back to that long list of, for women, the things that get in the way, the physiological, the psychological, so the physical, the psychological, and the relational. Now there is research being done on the development of a medication that will stimulate women's sexual desire. In the States it's called Librido. It's a combination of neurotransmitters that both stimulate and relax at the same time. But it's not on the market yet. There is a version of this on the market, but it has been found not to be very successful or good. So you have to go back to when a woman finds it difficult to get aroused or to have an orgasm, to go back to helping them to enjoy the physical relationship without the expectation of intercourse. To enjoy cuddling and hugging and stroking and massage, and maybe not even touching the genitals until the woman is ready and comfortable with that. That's what we call non-demand genital pleasuring. So they may pleasure different parts of the body, eventually pleasuring the genitals, but not demanding intercourse as an end result. So the whole aim of that is to help them both to be more relaxed in this process. Now, the research on the differences of arousal in men and women shows that it's very easy for men, it's much more complicated for women. Many more things interfere with it, but if women make the choice to say, I would like to make love with my husband, and we will cuddle and we will hug and we will have some non-genital caressing and stimulation, when they make that choice, very often, as their bodies become aroused, then they begin to desire it and want it. So it's more of a choice rather than for a man. It just seems like they're driven to it. And for a woman, of course, when they do get aroused, it's not so visible. For a man, he has an erection. For a woman, she may not even know that there is lubrication in the vagina when there is actually some with arousal. But it's much, much harder for her to know when it's happening in the early stages. So another area of helping women, which is many women find really difficult, is in the area when they have a lot of inhibitions about sex and their bodies, helping them to know their bodies, to touch their bodies. So for a woman who has a lot of inhibitions, who has never masturbated in her life, to learn to touch her vagina and to touch her clitoris and to know what is stimulating, to be able to tell her husband where to touch her. But first of all, to be comfortable touching herself and to be able to, more comfortable, as I said, in looking in a mirror and even examining her sexual organs with a mirror. So it's about learning to be comfortable with the body God has given you and with your sexuality. Teaching relaxation exercises, what we call Kegel exercises, the Kegel muscle, which is the muscle that goes from the front of your pelvis to the back, from the pubic bone to the coccyx. If you exercise that regularly, for both men and women actually, it helps arousal and orgasm. So there are physical things you can do. And then, as I've mentioned, renewing the mind, using good imagination and fantasy within the bounds of the marriage. And of course, one of the problems with men, with both men and women who have been involved in pornography, they have a whole library of really unhelpful images in their head. Many men have said to me, "I wish I didn't have all those images." And the woman have said, "I wish he didn't have all those images in his head because I feel that he's comparing with me." So talking about all of that is part of sexual counseling. Helping them to sort of build the sexual tension, working with the husband to help him to be more sensitive to the complexities of female sexuality. So that's education. So these are the sort of fundamental things we've talked about here. The assessment and understanding in hearing the story, asking good questions, being very specific about what it is. You can't talk in general terms. You have to be very specific about, you know, what is hard for you when he does that, or what helps you to feel aroused. So talking about sex, educating, talking about how they communicate, whether they are sensitive to each other's needs, whether maybe the husband or the wife are too harsh or critical, talking about shame from the past, and then dealing with the specific physical problems and helping them to have a biblical perspective on all of this. This young woman who grew up with a very negative attitude, I gave her this book, A Celebration of Sex. Well, I gave them both the book. And I said, what I want you to do is read this book individually and together. It's quite a big book, Celebration of Sex. And it's a wonderful description of the goodness of sex, which she found really hard to take. And then it goes on in the second half to deal with all the problems of arousal and desire and premature ejaculation. So it's a good troubleshooting book. It's a manual to have for your marriage long term. The book Sheet Music is a more contemporary book, good for couples just getting into marriage. Maybe to read before they get married. Now you may have others, you who are counselors here, Yelena, you may know of books that are good this side of the Atlantic, but the celebration of sex has been around for a long time and has stood the test of time.